We are talking today with Milan Rai. Milan Rai founded the British branch of Voices in the Wilderness and co-founded the anti-war group Arrow and its successor organization Justice Not Vengeance. He is the author of four books, Chomsky's Politics, War Plan Iraq, 10 Reasons Why We Shouldn't Launch Another War on Iraq, Regime Unchanged, and his new book, 7-7, The London Bombings, Islam, and the Iraq War. Milan, thank you very much for spending time with us today.
Thank you very much for inviting me on.
If you would begin and tell us, what was the motivation in writing your book, 7-7?
Well, I had two main motivations. One of them was I was monitoring the press very closely after the attacks on the 7th of July last year in London, and I was very frustrated about the very important information that would appear in the press, which was important for us to have a rational debate about terrorism and the crisis that we're in, which would appear, and then it would sort of disappear as though it had never been, and the discussion would carry on, the debate would carry on, as though we hadn't had that leak from inside the government, we hadn't had that intelligence report come out and so on. And I wanted to bundle together lots of important information which was relevant to the debate and kind of put it into a book form so that people who wanted to inject a little bit of realism into the debate would have a handy reference book, and some of these revelations from within government would get a little bit more exposure. The other major motivation was that I was reading about survivors of the attacks and family members who were seeking answers to the question why, and they were saying things like, I'm reading the Quran, I'm reading about the Middle East, I'm trying to understand, and I didn't feel that simply from that people were really going to get a coherent picture. And I think trying to understand an act of terrorism by reading the Quran is a little bit like saying I'm going to understand the bombing of Hiroshima by reading an atomic physics textbook. You know, you could use that textbook in many different ways, and when I read the Quran, I see many different strands in it, which you could take in, you know, all sorts of different ways. You can take bits of it towards nonviolence, you can take bits of it towards violence, you can take bits of it just to help you get through the day and so on. I think that's true of all the sacred texts which I've looked at anyway, that they can be used for many different purposes. So I wanted to write a book which might give a survivor, someone who lost someone in the attacks, a coherent explanation of what happened, and I wanted to write it in a way that such a person might feel that their experience had been respected. And so those were the two main motivations.
And for people who might not remember exactly what had happened on 7-7, can you kind of give us a brief overview of what happened that day?
Sure. Well, there were three young men from Leeds and another young Muslim from another part of Britain who went down to King's Cross Station in London, and then they went in four different directions, and three of them exploded their bombs on underground trains underneath London, and one of them, for reasons we're not entirely clear about, came up back up from the underground and caught a bus, and he exploded his bus over an hour later above ground near Euston Station. So four bombs went off, and apart from the suicide bombers themselves, 52 people were killed. And then 2 weeks later, another group, who seemed to have been an independent group, tried to carry out pretty much a replica attack, except that we were lucky, and the preparation process for their bombs seems to have been inefficient in some way, and the bombs didn't go off. So there were two attacks in July. One of them was successful and killed 52 Londoners, a cross-section of people. And there was a second attack on the 21st of July, which luckily didn't harm anyone.
And you mentioned in your intro that there were revelations coming out of the government. What did they discover, and what did you start discovering in your research for the book?
Well, there were a lot of revelations coming out of the government. Some of them were to do with declassified documents coming out of British intelligence and so on. The most amazing factor, which should have been part of the debate, was a report which was leaked to the Sunday Times, which they published on their website on the 10th of July, just 3 days after the attacks, which you can still find on the Sunday Times website. And that report was compiled by the Home Office, which is in charge of domestic affairs, and the Foreign Office, with intelligence input, and it's called Young Muslims and Extremism. Now, within days, the biggest topic in Britain was how could four young men in this frame of mind, how could four young men end up attracted to extremism of this character? So you would have thought that a secret government report into this topic would play a significant part in the debate. But once it was published, it virtually disappeared from view. There were like five mentions in the newspapers between then and the end of the year. And I think the reason why was because the conclusions of this secret inquiry, which had been completed a year earlier, were rather explosive and ones that were rather uncomfortable for the government, which were in public was saying this has got nothing to do with the Iraq war or British foreign policy, and was too hot to handle for the media. So it seems, anyway, because in the list of reasons why young Muslims in Britain were being attracted to extremism, the top reason in this internal report, which was not meant for publication, was British foreign policy. And it said in that report that the perception amongst British Muslims of British foreign policy before 9/11 was one of passive oppression, i.e. not really caring too much about the oppression of Muslims in Chechnya, Palestine, Indian-occupied Kashmir, and so on. And after 9/11, the perception had changed to one of active oppression with the invasion of Afghanistan and the invasion of Iraq and other ways in which Britain's involved in the US-led war on terror, as it's called. So according to that report, the level of hatred had increased with these changes in British foreign policy, and that was precisely the opposite of what the British government was trying to say in public. So that was a really important document, and it's staggering that it has virtually been censored from the public debate. And so my book is just one attempt to try and draw a little bit more attention to it again.
So do you feel that report then was pretty accurate? Did that point to the causes of this particular incident?
Well, I think if you want to be confident about what caused these attacks, you've got to look at the guys who carried it out and try to work out what we know about how they got from being just ordinary guys, completely westernized in their teenage years and uninterested in religion, uninterested in Pakistani culture. Three of them were of Pakistani heritage. You know, just guys being part of wider British society, listening to pop music and all that kind of stuff, and not interested in all that stuff. How they got from there to being devotees of Osama bin Laden. And we know quite a lot about that. And from the accounts of people who knew them, the turning point for them was when they started getting access to and watching DVDs of suffering in countries around the world, like Chechnya and so on, where Muslims were suffering, and they were watching atrocity videos, basically, of terrible things happening to Muslims around the world. And those are accompanied by calls to action and calls to feel responsibility for your Muslim brothers and sisters. And that was really the driver for them starting to go down this road. And they sought this stuff out. No one forced them. No one hauled them off to Al-Qaeda summer camp and kind of, you know, cut them off from the rest of the world and bombarded them with this stuff. They sought it out. They sought out images, they sought out writings, they sought out websites, they sought out training manuals, and they formed a group which did kind of training kind of stuff. They played military games, they went whitewater rafting, they went hiking together. They were kind of training themselves for the fight in defense of their brothers and sisters. Now, for many, many young Muslims, what that has meant is going off to Bosnia, going off to Afghanistan or whatever, and fighting alongside the people there who are suffering under attack. But for a tiny proportion of angry young Muslims who feel this intimate connection, brother-sister connection with people who are suffering around the world, for a tiny proportion of them, they don't feel that that's enough. And that's what happened to these guys. And they were pulled in the direction of the bin Laden strategy, which is not go to where people are suffering and fight alongside them and try to defend them, but attack the head of the snake, attack the people who are behind the people who are carrying out this oppression in Chechnya and so on. And on that analysis, the United States and Britain are the head of the snake. And for these guys, I think it's pretty clear that the war in Iraq was an enormous event in their lives. So the leader of the group, Muhammad Sadiq Khan, people who knew him said you could not actually discuss the war in Iraq with him. He would just explode in a way that meant you couldn't have a rational discussion. And so I think it's pretty clear that after the invasion of Iraq, there is a ramping up of their attraction to this kind of ideology and to this kind of political violence. But from everything that British intelligence and the police have uncovered, there was no external mastermind. There was no control from some other group in Britain. There was no control from some other group in Pakistan. There was no control from bin Laden or Ayman al-Zawahiri, his right-hand man. They basically were self-starters. And of the people who are on trial in London, who I couldn't write about in the book because it's sub judice and there's going to be a trial about it, that's the picture that people have put forward to describe those people who are on trial, that they seem also to be in self-starters, as was also the case with the Madrid bombers, who were not under the control of anybody else. They were merely inspired to action by the bin Laden analysis and the bin Laden call to action.
So when you say the bin Laden analysis and call to action, that's, as far as I can tell, there's no direct connection between the two. They just had seen what has been attributed to bin Laden, his actions internationally, and mimicked that?
Well, in the video that Muhammad Sadiq Khan, the leader of this group who attacked on the 7th of July, left behind, he praises Osama bin Laden, and he kind of gives in capsule the Osama bin Laden message, which is Muslims are under attack, the West is either carrying out these attacks or is behind these attacks. As long as you keep doing it, we're going to attack you. I am a soldier. This is a war. And, you know, he kind of gives a very brief and rather prosaic version of it in a Northern English accent, which is very disconcerting for a lot of people in England to hear the Al-Qaeda message delivered to them in a Yorkshire accent. So as far as we can tell, and as far as the British police and intelligence services have been able to determine, there is no command from outside. There is no real communication with the Al-Qaeda Corps or any of the Al-Qaeda networks. They're not really connected. They're below the radar for that reason. And the point is, with these people, police and intelligence methods are not going to detect every friendship group of young Muslims who are angry about things that are happening in the world, who are not in communication with anybody who's being monitored. If they're not in communication with the groups who are being monitored, you can't detect all of them before they do something. The only way you can stop those guys doing things is by reducing their motivation to do stuff. And that's why the message of this book really is, if we want to protect our family and friends and neighbors and communities, we have to reduce the motivation that's driving these people to do this stuff, who we can't detect all of them. And the way to do that is by obeying international law, by obeying the UN Charter, by not committing crimes against other people and not supporting regimes that are oppressing Muslims around the world or anybody else. So the message of this book is, if we do the right thing, we'll also do the safer thing. And that's got to start with the withdrawal from Iraq and Afghanistan, which are the most vital recruiting agents for Al-Qaeda right now. But if we do the right thing, we'll also be helping to protect our families. And you see, what Bush and Blair say is the exact opposite. Because of the threat, we have to fight the wars. Because of the threat, we have to pass this repressive legislation, which is going to be used in a discriminatory way against Muslims, as we're seeing in Britain right now, in a very cruel fashion, and we're seeing in Guantanamo and so on. But in fact, the exact opposite is true. If we treat people fairly, and if we have more freedom rather than less freedom, and if we treat people internationally fairly, and we stop having these wars of aggression, and we stop backing dictators and so on, we'll actually be making ourselves safer.
Obviously, one of the factors here that people are focusing on is the fact that these were Muslims. Yet, I had gotten the impression from when you first started that these weren't fundamentalists or violent fundamentalists. So, is it your impression that they went through some kind of I don't know, the closest thing I can think of is like born-again Christians. Is that what appears to have happened here?
in the Muslim community, they refer to people who come back to Islam as reverts, but I think for non-Muslims, the terminology of born again is absolutely accurate, and what seems to happen to these guys is very much that they were born again. And I don't know a whole lot about people who are born again Christians, but what happened with these guys is that when they were born again into a very different brand of Islam than they had been raised with. They'd been raised with this very kind of secluded, quietistic, family-oriented Islam, and the Islam that they adopted and which they gave their lives for was very much a publicly engaged, world community of Muslims-oriented an activist form of Islam, which is completely the polar opposite of what they were raised with. So it's virtually a different religion, really. And as I was saying before, you know, we know a little bit about what triggered this off. Probably, you know, some of what triggered it off was to do with the social conditions they were living under and the kind of Islamophobic tendencies in British society and so on, which may have predisposed them to start thinking this way. That wasn't, as far as we understand it, the really big triggering event which drove them in this direction. Now, one of the interesting things I found out when researching this book is that most Islamic fundamentalists in the world and most Islamic fundamentalists in the West are not violent. What they're doing is they're setting up little communities, enclaves, within which they can have the right society. They are segregating themselves off from what they regard as the non-Islamic society. It could be a Muslim society like Egypt, but they're making a little, you know, place where you can be the proper Muslim. And that's what most Islamic fundamentalists are doing. They're not going out and fighting the fight with guns. They're fighting the fight spiritually by making a little community where you can do things the right way as they see it. So within the Islamic fundamentalist community, only a pretty small minority are taking up arms. And within that violent Islamic fundamentalist minority, only a tiny minority of them believe in the bin Laden go and blow up something in the West kind of strategy. Most of the violent Islamic fundamentalists see their job as fighting in Chechnya, in Egypt, or wherever, to take down the oppressive government that is oppressing the Muslims. So these young men were drawn towards a violent extremist form of Islamic fundamentalism, but most of the Islamic fundamentalists in Britain, they're not involved in violence, and they're certainly not involved in the bin Laden brand of attack the head of the snake, bomb Britain, bomb the United States kind of violence. If they are drawn to violence, most of them are saying, I'm going to go and fight in Chechnya, I'm going to go and try and protect people in Chechnya, I'm going to go to Afghanistan or whatever, which is a very different kind of moral question, I think. Because personally, I don't think that going and fighting alongside oppressed peoples who are being slaughtered is in and of itself an immoral thing. You might do it in an immoral way, in the way that you treat people, and then I would say that's immoral, that's criminal. You might do it fighting for a group which isn't just defending people, but which is trying to impose on people in the region some very brutal system. And if you were doing that, then I would say that's immoral. But simply saying, I'm going to go and give my life fighting alongside people getting slaughtered, that's just like going to Spain during the Civil War and saying, you know, I want to give my life to protect the Spanish people from fascism. It's pretty much the same thing. In Britain, it has been criminalized now. But I think I don't agree with that. I don't see how that's justified. Just because someone wants to go to a foreign country where they feel a connection to people who are suffering and take up arms, that's not, I think, immoral and criminal in and of itself. It's how you do it, I think.
It's interesting that here in the U.S. there also appears to be a growing fundamentalist movement, but appears to be Christian fundamentalists. And I have heard from others who are saying that a large part of the contributing factor of that is the polarization in the politics that we're all experiencing now. So I'm just wondering if you think that's valid, that this push for fundamentalism, so that helps people explain or understand how the world works.
I think that point about, you know, how the world works is really crucial. And I think in the Islamic world, as in the Christian world and elsewhere, the drive for a kind of a rigid orthodoxy and fundamentalism and literalism about your religion. Very often that comes when people feel that the decent social order is coming apart. Now, for a lot of people, there's a lot of anthropologists and sociologists have said that very often that happens when people move from kind of the stable peasant life of the countryside to the city, and then suddenly you go from this situation where you know how things work, you know what your obligations to each other are, and then you're in the city where it's dog eat dog, and it's, you know, all relationships are basically by cash rather than you have mutual responsibilities to each other, and some of them are kind of oppressive, but someone may be oppressing you, but they've still got duties of care towards you, you know, in a kind of a peasant society, a feudal society. And that is happening all around the world to a certain extent, not necessarily a move from a feudal situation to the city, but a lot of us all around the world are experiencing the breakdown of our social order within which we have bonds that we understand and relationships that we understand. And a lot of that is happening because of the way that the corporate economy is breaking up social bonds, and we're being forced to be more flexible, and we're being forced to feel more powerless over our own lives by the way that our economic structures are developed. And I think that one way of recreating a kind of a stable social order is through a kind of fairly rigid interpretation of religion, where you know what the situation is, you know what the relationships are, and you feel you're recreating a stable and decent moral universe. That's one way of doing it. Now, there are other ways of doing it, and, you know, they're not necessarily mutually incompatible, but, you know, another way of responding to that economic insecurity and so on is to form a union and fight right for your rights and create a kind of an alternative moral universe in which people aren't just units of production, but, you know, they have a right to a living wage and to working conditions which are decent and which respect their dignity and so on. You know, you can have different kinds of ways of making an alternative moral universe. But I think I'll make one last point about fundamentalism, which is that very often people are attracted to fundamentalism when they feel that their security is threatened. But for some people, that's the security of privilege. So for many men in a patriarchal society, when patriarchal power seems to be under threat, they feel insecure. Now, what's happening is they're going from a position of having too much privilege to moving towards equality. But what they feel is that they're in a victimized minority. And in that kind of situation, you can be attracted to fundamentalism because it shores up that system of order within which authority relations are reestablished in the way that you feel they should be. So it's not necessarily because you're an oppressed person whose security is being threatened in the sense that you are going further down the chain. Sometimes people are attracted to fundamentalism because they are in a privileged situation and they feel their privilege is under threat. But psychologically, both people feel frightened of what's coming and maybe of liberalism, modernism, something which is, they can both be persuaded is the same kind of a thing, and they can both be attracted to the same religious interpretation to try to give them a secure place to stand and a safe place to be, a safe community to recreate.
Did you come across anything that surprised you when you were researching your book?
I came across so many things, particularly about Islam, particularly about Muslim communities. You know, I was amazed by lots of things that I found out, most of which came into the book. And one of the things was that, you know, the reason why Islam is in the subtitle is because one reaction to the bombings was, well, you know, Islam is an inherently violent religion. You know, what do you expect? That was a reaction in Britain. I'm not sure if it was the majority reaction, but it was a big reaction. And I wanted to counter that, and I wanted to examine that. So, you know, people quote verses from the Quran, and they say, hey, look, Muhammad said, kill the unbelievers wherever you find them. Okay, there's this famous sword verse. And I went and looked at it, and I looked at the commentaries, and I found out that that's one interpretation, you know, that verse says, kill the unbelievers or idolaters wherever you find them. Okay, that's one interpretation of it, and that's the interpretation that Bin Laden has, and it's the interpretation that the Islamophobes have. But there are other interpretations, and there's a perfectly reasonable and historically valid interpretation, which is that when Muhammad said that, the Muslims had just been chased out of Mecca under the threat of extermination by the majority religion in Mecca, and Mecca was seeking to exterminate them. And when you look at the verse, what it says is, kill the idolaters wherever you find them, unless they repent. So that last little bit usually is left out by people who are quoting the verse. And what was happening was that the Muslims were fighting for their lives, and when it says unbelievers or idolaters, there's a perfectly valid historical interpretation, which is Muhammad was speaking of the Meccans who are trying to exterminate them. And therefore, as soon as that form of Meccan paganism is no longer, actually, it doesn't no longer exist, then that verse no longer has any force, because it was a specific response to that specific historical situation where the Muslims were fighting for their existence against the religion in Mecca and the forces of Mecca. So, you know, there are a number of different interpretations of that verse, and it's the Islamophobes who say, no, this is the real message of Muhammad. I know what Muhammad was saying, and he was saying, kill all the unbelievers wherever you find them. Well, that's one interpretation, but how can anyone, especially a non-Muslim, and I'm not a Muslim, how can any non-Muslim say, I know what Muhammad was saying. I know that he didn't mean it as a historically limited injunction. I know that he meant it as a message for all time and against everyone who doesn't believe in Islam. And incidentally, if that word is idolater, then it could not apply to Christians and Jews, because Muhammad recognized that Christians and Jews were not idol worshippers. They worshipped a God who he regarded as the same God that he was building his religion around and that he had been inspired by. So, you know, there's a lot of stuff in the book, and I was amazed about some things in the life of Muhammad. You know, for 13 years, Muhammad led a life of non-violent resistance to the oppression which he and the Muslims were suffering in Mecca, where they were being harassed, they were being kind of beaten up, they were being humiliated in the street and so on. And Muhammad was telling his followers, don't react with violence. And he himself tried to respond, by the accounts that we have, with kindness to the people who were oppressing him. Now, stuff like that, we're kind of not so aware of as Westerners who are non-Muslims. And, you know, I know Muslims who are committed to non-violence and peace, and that's the strand of Islam that they look to for inspiration. And there are strands like that. They're not exactly what Jesus said and did, but they've got similarities. And when you look at some of the things that Muhammad says in the Quran of that period, there's a real kinship with what Jesus was saying during his much shorter ministry. You know, for 13 years, he was practicing non-violence in Mecca under enormous provocation and in quite a bit of danger. And, you know, yes, later on Muhammad was a conqueror and a ruler and so on. But there is a whole picture, and it has lots of different elements in it. And I know Muslims, and there are lots of Muslims around the world, who find inspiration in the gentle and non-violent and loving aspects of the Quran and of Muhammad's practice in his life. And who are we as non-Muslims to say, that's not the real Islam. The real Islam is this other stuff. I'm not in a position to say that. I don't think, as a non-Muslim, I'm in a position to say either Islam is a religion of war or Islam is a religion of peace. What I am in a position to say is someone who says one of those things is only selecting part of the tradition. And I can't say what the essence is. And the people who fear and hate Islam and they say it's inherently violent, they are being selective. And we need to educate ourselves more about the whole picture about Islam.
All right. Well, I want to thank you for spending time with us today.
Thank you very much for having me on the show.
We've just been talking with Milan Rai, author of the book 7-7, The London Bombings, Islam, and the Iraq War.